Welcome to the Wildly Capable Podcast by NovoEd, hosted by Todd Moran and Alex Gruen. On Wildly Capable, we explore unusual sources of deep capabilities and unexpected insights on human capital. In this episode, Todd and I interview Chris Bavona, Vice President of Human Resources for the Americas for Palfinger. Well, it's not the first time that we met, Chris, and we just talked about this before we got started, but we met last November when you came to NovoEd's Night of the Roundtable event with Stephen Shapiro and Bob Lee Wesley down in Orlando, and we hit it off immediately. And you shared pictures of your farm in North Carolina, of which I was and remain hugely jealous, especially after being cooped up in an apartment in New York City for the duration of the pandemic. And I know that living in the mountains of North Carolina is a bit of a full circle situation for you, in that you grew up in the Hudson Valley and worked on small community farms growing up. Can you talk a little bit about life on the farm now and then, and how some of these early experiences have had and continue to have bearing on your life, career, and perspective on human capital?
Sure. I think, first of all, I'd like to say I'm really blessed and fortunate. Even from the early days of growing up to where I am today. Often when you talk to people and you say you're from New York, and particularly in my journeys overseas, people would say, what part of the city? Or it must have been difficult to live among the concrete jungle. And my response was, well, I spent more time in my childhood, picking apples and potatoes and corn, on farms or painting houses than I did in New York City. But the truth is, the small community that I grew up in, it's called New Paltz in upstate New York. A lot of people know it as a very high-end climbing community, the Gunks or the Shangums, as they're known as big climbing. But to me, it was a small town, a college town. And most of the kids that I grew up with either owned farms, worked on farms, were small family. There was a group of people that worked at IBM when they were back up there. But as a kid, you always want to hang out with your friends. And I wound up doing that on a variety of farms. So whether it was vegetable farms, fruit farms, driving tractors. And I think what really impacted me at a young age growing up is, one, hard work, right? The farm life is hard work. You're up early. There are long days. There's both success and tragedy. I mean, we had floods that killed, the crops. They're customer focused. I mean, people come into the family farms in upstate New York, and it's interesting. A lot of the New York City folks would come up on the weekend and they'd come to the farms and, they'd have their big Cadillacs and I'd be loading apple crates into their cars and, they'd be screaming at me, don't scratch the paint. And I was like, scratch the paint. I mean, but I loved it. And my buddies and I had great time. We're still very, very close. I mean, I have 12 or 13 guys that I went from kindergarten through high school with that were still close. I mean, we have webcasts and one of them's an NFL announcer. It's just a wild group of people from a small community. I think in where I am today, so full circle, yes, I'm sure we'll dig into a little bit about my crazy journeys, but I lived in Raleigh for 30 years and my partner and I decided about 4 years ago to buy a property out in the mountains in North Carolina. And it is strikingly similar to where I grew up in upstate New York. It's the Appalachians. They're rolling, bumpy hills. And we got 12 acres. We've got a stream, a pond. Probably in a month, I'll be getting the first round of chickens. We're currently looking at some goats. I made a gigantic garden and have begun kind of mapping out that. So the truth is that I'm kind of going back to my roots. It's a small community. It's called West Jefferson, and I absolutely love it. And it's paradise. And I certainly invite you. I'd love for you to come down here at some point. Everybody wants to go to Asheville, but we're 2 hours north, but you can come in, enjoy the area, and then head to the other beautiful spots in Carolina.
Oh, so there.
Chris, I'd, I love the idea. It's interesting. I'm out in Colorado, and that part of a move neighborhood wise was getting out of a little bit of a local city, college town. I'm in Fort Collins, Colorado, CSU here, Colorado State University, and landed in a whole community built around CSA, community supported agriculture. So this idea of the importance of community building and shared experience and collective work ethic helped draw some parallels for me, because I experienced this in my own neighborhood. And I say, wow, in a corporate setting, like, is that something it should still be aspired to? Do we need sort of more of this community building piece? Or is it better that folks specialize, go off in their individual areas? And it's not, there is not this need to create this sort of collective growth together and in pursuit of joint project and overall effort. Would love to get your take on that.
Yeah, you know, I've been participating in quite a few global HR seminars, and it is amazing to me the transformation that's taking place in the workforce. And it's I don't want to say it's a grassroots effort, because those of us that have been, in the workforce for quite some time, we know that there's a changing landscape of what people want. They want more flexibility. They want career opportunities, career advancement. You know, people are looking for exciting challenges, but they're also looking for a personal connection. They want, either if they believe in sustainability, or if they believe in diversity and inclusion, or if they believe in global warming. And it's not just enough to have a job that pays the bills. They want to feel connected. And then you throw kind of this COVID in there, where people had the connections at work, but then they were forced to either work at home and do all the screen time. So they feel disconnected, but now they also have enjoyed a new lifestyle, working from home, spending time with the kids, taking the dog for a walk when they want, but they also want to be challenged. They want to be trusted. They want to be passionate about their jobs. And the age range that I'm seeing between 25 and 50, you know, people are asking for very different things. And, you know, the challenge that I'm hearing with a lot of my HR colleagues are, you know, the war for talent is a little bit overused. You know, we can't hire the right people for the right jobs. That seems a little tired. So the question is, do we shift the paradigm so that we actually hire people for a short period of time to do something that they're really passionate about, pay them well, give them benefits, and in 1 or 2 years, if the job is done, they go about their merry way and find a new opportunity, or we find something else for them to do. But I'm excited about where work is shifting. The challenge is, there's a lot of managers that are, I'm going to say, in the last quartile of their career, that this scares them to death. They want to see the people. They want butts in chairs. They feel that productivity is tied to eyeball. And I understand the cultural piece of that, but that's the big change and challenge that I think we're faced with.
Yeah, it's really intriguing. I think this sense, I think it came out of the workplace learning report towards the tail end of last year, but the sheer amount of folks that would be willing to sort of step out or of the workforce or into a new role that had potentially less compensation for some of those flexibility pieces, the sort of uniqueness of approach, that developmental opportunities, was sort of mind-boggling to me, that you're going to take sort of potential massive equal or massive pay cut to allow that sense of, you know, what I care about. And it might be short-lived. It might only be for a year and a half. And I wonder how other HR professionals, talent, L&D, are going to, will they embrace that and the potential need to sort of replace and replenish at pace? Or is that something they're going to ward off at all, at all costs, for as long as they can?
Yeah, I have this conversation with my HR team, and particularly with the Europeans. I've tried to hire, as I kind of rebuilt the organization here, I tried to hire really senior, experienced HR people, because there's that dichotomy of, you know, you have the firefighting every day, but you have to be strategic in your thinking, right? You don't change an organization by, you know, just doing the little things every day, but those things still have to get done. You know, the Europeans, you know, this is the third European company that I've worked for, and, you know, they have a very different model of, you know, workplace, even as basic as the employee contracts, right? In the US, you can give notice and walk out the door in 24 hours. In Europe, it's usually 3 to 6 months, right? And longer. They also aren't necessarily feeling, the great resignation or the challenges. So it's been interesting for me to kind of educate them on what's happening. And I have to split really the conversation into two categories. You've got the blue collar and then you've got the white collar. And the white collar is what everybody's, you know, all the attention is kind of focused on those individuals, you know, the hybrid work environments, the work from home, the challenges. But we can't forget the fact that, you know, for the last 20 to 30 years, we've been pushing people to go to college, get a degree, get these high-tech jobs, but we're trying to bring manufacturing back. And I don't know if you've tried to hire a plumber, an electrician, a welder, a skilled worker, you know, someone in that category. Not only is it impossible in the private sector, but in the public sector, you know, when we're trying to staff critical roles, it's nearly impossible. So we're trying to grow our own. We're working on apprenticeship programs. We're partnering with local universities. You know, at some point in time, the paradigm has to shift that, you know, we still need a lot of people and there's no shame. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of glory in, you know, skilled labor. And at the same time, how do you make these two really dynamic changes in the workforce gel? That's a big question.
Yeah, I love it, Chris. And maybe this idea of sort of grow your own and develop from within, I feel like that's going to be an ever more present focal point for so many organizations, you know, kind of across the globe. And I have to say, Alex, and I love the your mantra around global framework, regional alignment, local flavor. And it seems to be sort of in some ways the ideal framing for this conversation. And for that matter, you know, since we kicked off a little bit with the local flavor for you and your history and upbringing, tell us a little bit about what that mantra means more to you and why it's so important and should it be of equal importance to other talent professionals and other folks out there in similar lines.
I appreciate that. And I think it has been a growing mantra of mine. You know, when you grow up in a small community in upstate New York, I could barely point on a map to where Austria was or, you know, Japan. You kind of live in your own community. And, you know, when I got to college, obviously the world got a little bit bigger and the United States, you know, certainly became a smaller community. And then when I got stationed over in Germany, it was really a tremendous experience to live and work amongst Europeans, start traveling, get on the road. You can't read the road signs, things of that nature. And then, of course, when you travel the world for work, you really learn what true navigation and how to really move around the world and be successful and not be afraid. And I kind of like the global framework because in the end, we may have different customs, we may have different rules, we may have different regulations, but if a company has a certain culture, like they value people or learning and development or technology, that global framework can be driven down into whatever community you want, because it's a centralized theme, right? If you care about your people or if you care about talent, it doesn't matter if it's Japan or China or Russia or wherever, you know, that can be a theme. But regionally, when I say regionally, maybe North America, Latin America, Asia Pacific, or Europe, regionally, how things are done is unique. I mean, the way that they treat people in, you know, China is going to be different than the way we do in the United States. And then when you bring it down into local, you have to look at language, customs, culture, how people behave, the food that they eat. So when you talk about, let's say, a talent strategy for a global organization, what that means globally is take care of your talent. What it might mean in Latin America is, okay, Brazil has its own style, Argentina has its own style, Uruguay does, Mexico. But when you get down to Caxias del Sol, which is a small mountain community 2 hours north into the basically jungle of Brazil, you know, drinking caipirinhas and having meat and big barbecues is as much a part of their culture as, you know, showing up to work every day. And that is how you have to try to integrate, but not force a framework that doesn't work locally. And I've been so blessed and so fortunate to really live and see where there's common threads, but where we absolutely have to have that differentiation for local success.
So then, how is capable leadership perceived differently in all of these different domains, Chris, especially in Europe and Asia relative to the Americas?
And this is one where I would say it's bottom up. And this is probably one of my biggest pain points. There are a lot of leaders that aren't necessarily globally aware. And so they believe that their way of doing things is the way it needs to be done. And my job in working with my managers and leaders is you've got to meet in the middle. First of all, you have to ask a lot of questions. You have to really understand when someone says, I want X, you know, what does X mean? What does it mean to you? What does it mean to the function? And how does that impact what I do every day? And then the people below have to have the courage. And I would say Americans are probably more courageous than a lot of other cultures. Some of the other cultures tend to be very subservient because they're very hierarchical in their thinking, particularly the, you know, Asia Pacific cultures, the Latin American cultures. Europeans are a little bit more like Americans. But when the boss says, do it, jump, they may say, how high? You know, my philosophy with leaders is when the boss says jump, the first question is, okay, tell me what you mean by jump. You know, is it vertical? Is it up? Is it to the side? Where are we going? Why are we doing it? How does this link to our strategy? And the idea is to really collaborate with managers and help them understand. And it's very much like a spinning top. They can make one small turn at the top. At the bottom, everybody starts turning really, really fast. So I just tell them, slow down, ask the questions, connect with the people, understand your way may still be the most impactful, but you really have to understand what it means for the people all the way through the organization.
And now that there's another sort of wrench that's been thrown in into that dynamic and relationship, and that because remote work's become the norm, right? And you have all these blurred global boundaries that are having bearing on that process. What bearing does that have on those types of conversations in corporate leadership moving forward when folks can't be in the same room and it's harder to ask those questions and you're operating across a bunch of different time zones and spaces?
I think that's, people are really struggling, right? The particularly folks like us that are relationship-based, eyeball to eyeball, you can see, and you know, those of us that are, and I know you're, Alex, an expert in communication, but you know, written words only translate what, 7% of the message. And then you have tone and intonation and body language, which are about 85% of the rest of the message. You know, you can get a little bit of that through the Zoom calls, but half the time people aren't putting their cameras on. But let me go back to the direct question. I think people are trying to ask two primary questions. Who am I as a leader? How effective am I as a leader? And how do I connect with every individual to understand the impact that they can have in their roles? And so many people have become robotic in, here's the global strategy, or here's what we need to get done, the MBOs, put it in an email, send it out with a task list, and follow up weekly with a call to make sure that, you know, XYZ is done. And what they're finding is one, people are overwhelmed with email. Two, because they don't have that connection, they're not responsive. So how do you manage that? You can't be an ostrich and bury your head in the sand. You have to be proactive. You have to be in uncomfortable positions. You have to learn to lead from the sidelines and not always from the top. And there's a lot of people that are finding out that they're not cut out, that they can't cut the mustard. And so we're at this dichotomy right now.
Chris, I'd love to extrapolate that for us a little bit, because I one, agree with that assessment wholeheartedly. Two, I think about what happens when it needs to extend beyond the leaders. I know that there was sort of this ever push the last few years to say, we need STEM skills. We need these types of capabilities. And I think the realization of that and sort of the more sort of borne out research of the last, you know, 18 months coupled with the pandemic is saying, my Lord, like, take a pause. I think what we're really after is, you know, skill sets and capabilities that are around flexible, agile, adaptable to change, you know, time management, ability to work effectively in different environments, you know, capacity for innovation and creativity, resiliency, all these other pieces that maybe sort of pushed down have sort of bubbled up. And it's not just for leaders. Or I want to ask you, do you think that should be a skill set of sort of universal uplift across organizations, or are we just more in needing to equip a handful, a select few with sort of this approach?
No, it has to be across the organization. And I think I was, when I was talking to Alex about this in my initial experience in Germany, you know, there's the expression of the ugly Americans. And when a lot of Americans travel overseas, and people don't speak English, what do Americans do? We talk louder and louder and louder. And they expect that you know, someone who's German or Turkish or, you know, from the hills of Switzerland is going to understand because we yell louder. And I think that what people were starting to say is, well, this pandemic's going to get over. So if I just pound the table harder and force people to do more, that they're going to get it done because they're going to want to come back to the office and they're going to be overly excited to get the work done. Well, no, it's not about talking louder. It's about changing the entire landscape. Learn the language or use the tools that you have. Use Google Translate, whatever. People have to think differently from the start. And it's from the top, it's from the bottom, it's from the middle. And collaboration has never been more important because there are people that have really good skills in that. They know how to communicate. They know how to collaborate. They understand how to have difficult conversations. There are people that have never had the training, don't know how to do it, and really, really struggle. And what they do is they talk louder and they just create more barriers and walls.
Yeah, I think, you know, we as, you know, professionals in this space and a provider in this space need to sort of, you know, fundamentally sort of revisit, like, where are we putting our degree of emphasis and focus on that? Because it's going to be a scary thing if we're not putting that, I think, emphasis. And all of a sudden we have, you know, multiple years now. I look at like what's happening in the parallels in educational world, and you've got folks and kiddos that have been learning in isolation, and the massive gap they have now in sort of their social abilities and ability to interact in classrooms and deal with conflict management, you know, in the elementary school age is frightening. I mean, yeah. Teachers are putting them 18 plus months behind. So what's the parallel in the work setting if these folks don't have these opportunities, or we don't find a way to kind of get to them in that manner?
Well, it's interesting because I have two boys. One is a senior in college. The other is a freshman in college. And my senior is a double major, biology and Spanish. And for 2 years, he was trying to get overseas, or he wanted to do a semester abroad. Which I, of course, encouraged. And he finally was able to travel to Granada, Spain, for his final semester of college. So he's a senior. He is now in Granada, Spain, you know, kind of living in a community and getting his, you know, what I would call his full-on Spanish immersion in Spain. And I couldn't be happier for him. And we talk once a week. We lived abroad when he was younger. He's traveled abroad, but living. And he said to me the other day, actually Sunday when I talked to him, he said, "Dad," he said, "I knew this was going to be a phenomenal experience." He said, "But every one of my expectations has been exceeded." And he's only been there like 4 weeks. So I couldn't be happier. The poor guy for 2 years was in college in a dorm room, stuck staring at a computer screen. I mean, I know we all probably went to college in a very different environment. My college freshman spent the last 2.5 years of his high school education, you know, stuck in my basement learning, which, you know, when I see the kids and I was actually, I'll call myself a genius. I just think I'm lucky. I put a gym in the basement of my house 4 years ago. Fully, I said, why am I paying fees for the YMCA when, you know, really? So I had a treadmill, an elliptical, I bought a bunch of weights, I had some rack machines. So my house effectively became the YMCA when everything was shut down. And so I had the kids socialize. And for a while they were doing video games and whatnot. And I said, guys, you know what? You're going to suffer some consequences that you probably aren't aware of because you're not socializing. So I'll tell you what, do something as a community. I don't care what it is, but let's figure it out. And I will tell you that five of them now, they started a band. They learned guitar, drums, variety, keyboard. And so they're all in different colleges. But, you know, now I've got five musicians that are really enjoying a whole different community. They're socializing online. And okay, that may be one rare example, but I was thrilled to have an impact. And then hopefully people are understanding that you can't wait for somebody else to take the action. You have to drive it. You have to be the roots that then the tree can grow and then expand. There are a lot of people that are waiting for somebody else to provide the answers. Don't wait, just do it.
And I love the idea of, you know, sort of an analogous to maybe more so on the corporate side, like you helped create the environment. Now, did you push, did you dictate, did you direct, did you sort of make it a sort of a charter? No, you simply sort of created that environment where you're asking for that innovation, that creativity to sort of sprout. And it did so wonderfully, which is exciting.
This also might be a great segue into a question around early experiences that you had in sales, Chris. You started your career. Well, first, I'll mention that you started your career, and a lot of your early international experience abroad was with the Army. You were 5 years in the Army Medical Services Corps overseas, and then you came back and worked in sales roles at Baxter and Becton Dickinson. And my question is, what bearing did all three of those experiences, being overseas, working for and building MASH, right? And then coming back over here and selling for Baxter, Becton, Dickinson, and then later at UNC as its executive education department's first business development manager, that's since helped you in your HR leadership and people strategy roles.
It's interesting, and when I talk to people about my career, first of all, thank you for the question. You know, I look back and as I was trying to put together kind of a time frame, in a weird way, it makes sense, the progression. And as I had shared with you, when I went to University of Richmond, I had no intentions of going into the Army. Didn't even cross my mind. But my parents had, I had a brother and sister in college, and when tuition started to skyrocket, I was either going to head back to New York to a SUNY school or find a different way to pay for college. And, you know, I walked into the ROTC department. I fell in love with the captain who was the recruiter, and the rest is history. So I was a bio major in college, which I was planning. My goal when I got to college was to be a professor. I wanted to be a college professor in biology. So graduating, I was fortunate to get the Medical Service Corps branch, and then I got stationed over in Germany. And, you know, primarily for the 5 years, we were doing medical support for field exercises. Basically, the unit that I was a part of was called the Meat Grinder. And this was still when, you know, the Berlin Wall was up and, you know, Russia was still kind of a hot zone. You know, our goal was to basically be the first wall, and I was the first medical support in case there was any kind of conflict. Well, our unit, and I'll just tell a very quick story. We were all sitting around on Thanksgiving Day, kind of watching, you know, TV. There's a bunch of officers sitting in an officers club. And at the bottom of the screen, there comes this announcement about the divisions that are then going to be deployed to Iraq for the, or to Kuwait for the conflict. And they listed our division, and all of us start looking around saying, what, did you see that correctly? So then the phone started ringing. But anyway, going over to the Gulf, the first Gulf War, was an amazing experience, because you realize that all the preparation that you do day in and day out in a peacetime situation, it becomes turnkey, right? You knew how to pack your bags. You knew how to get to the vehicles. You knew the line. I mean, it was so rigorous and so professionally designed. You know, the next thing I know, we're in Iraq, the unit's there, everything was fine. And we performed perfectly, right? Everything was done exactly the way it should be. When I got out and I came back, as I had mentioned to you, the economy wasn't the best in 91 and 92. And the recruiters that help, you know, young officers get out of the military said, well, you have a couple of career choices. You can do sales or you can do sales. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I guess I'll do sales. So medical sales was really a great fit. And when I joined with Baxter is a company that does hire quite a few military professionals. So I was surrounded by, I mean, my boss was an ex-military guy. But what was interesting, when I started selling, it was basically walking into laboratories in like Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, and I was working in New Jersey. You know, people, as a captain in the Army, and I'm not an ego guy, I'm not a title-driven guy, but there's just this kind of hierarchy of respect. And I tell you what, the first 6 months, I felt like I was a private. I mean, people just dogged you. As a sales rep, they treated you pretty tough. And I thought, God, I've been shot at, but some of these researchers here, they can make you feel about an inch high. But what was important is I really learned the value of relationships, right? You know, you have to be honest, have your integrity, you know, don't sell people what they don't want. And that whole foray into the world of sales was really eye-opening. I became great friends with a lot of people. To this day, I'm still friends with some of my customers. I then took the job with BD down in North Carolina and kind of furthered my relationships with sales. And then at some point, I really got the passion for learning and development for people and really how you can have an impact in a different way. So I would say that the sales experience, and I say this to this day, anybody in a professional career, whether it's finance, HR, if you've carried a bag, if you have felt the pain down at the customer level, you'll be a lot more effective in your job. And I'm a much better HR professional. As I say, I've been to a lot of conferences, a lot of training. I do training. I didn't go to HR charm school, but the fact that I've spent so much time in the business with the customers, I'm so much better able to organize and structure how my department runs, how we function. And I attribute that to the sales and the military, right? The structure and, you know, carrying a bag. And I try to just maintain that level of integrity throughout my team and what I do every day.
Chris, I love it, this idea. I mean, we often engage with clients so often about what's that balance between structure and just sort of allowing individual pursuit when it comes to sort of self-development. And, you know, there's no one right answer to that. But I think more and more this idea of, you know, give a little bit of guidance and pathing to sort of an approach and then put the emphasis where it needs to be on the relationships, on sort of the building a network, on sort of feeling what it's like to sort of be in the shoes of others in functional areas. And then you're yelling at the product and services team. Have you been on the front lines of them as they're dealing with customers left, right, and center? Or you're angry at the sort of the supply chain network, but have you ever spent time on the shop floor and understand what happens when things break down? That idea of this, and I feel like, and would love to get your take on the overarching HR front, especially in your current state role of, you know, is this idea of sort of cross-pollinating and in allowing folks with these rotational opportunities for development, is that important, or should we keep this focus on specialization? And that really needs to be the anchor point for folks in corporations moving forward.
That's, you know, I would say I have to answer that a couple of different ways, because HR, I mean, every function has its core activities, but they have their specialist activities. HR over the years has become a gigantic function, right? That crosses so many different areas. What I will say is there are so many critical areas in HR that require deep expertise. Compensation and benefits is so complicated in today's market. You want experts in that area. Recruiting, you need really good recruiters in today's market, without question. When it comes to HR analytics and reporting, you need people with deep expertise on systems, on knowledge. Where I would say the cross-functional benefit, there's this loose term of HR business partner, right? If you're an HR business partner or a people strategy consultant, those are the folks that should spend time in another function, you know, marketing, sales, finance. I don't care where you work. But if you're going to be a partner with the business to do things like organizational design, developing learning programs, you can't do it from the outside. You have to be on the inside. You have to have felt the pain of, you know, XYZ to advise, as opposed to, you know, hey, I understand I've got this HR background and I read a book on organizational design. Let me fix you. Doesn't work that way. But the experts we clearly need, and, you know, the centers of excellence in HR are pretty clear right now how people are managing, but it's the HR business partners, and in particular the leader. I think it would be huge to rotate people into different functions and then bring people into HR so they have a better appreciation for the chaos that we have to manage day in and day out.
No doubt. As a quick follow-up to that, there's we discussed this, Todd, you and I discussed it with Brian Padilla from Lionsgate. There's this trend around generalism being desirable and T and U leadership being desirable. relative to specialization. So if you're at the if you're at the beginning of your career, Chris, like, does it make sense to go full throttle into something that's super specific, or does it make sense to go and touch a bunch of different domains and disciplines and then try to specialize later on?
That is such an individual, question. Some people, and you've probably taken a whole lot of personality assessments, tests, whatever you want to say. Some of them will point you in the direction of, you should be a finance manager, you should be a zookeeper, who knows. What I will tell you is, and you know this, 30% of the jobs that are going to exist in the next 5 years don't exist today. There's this point of where I think there's the need to experience a variety of different things so that you can understand what your passion is. There are lots of tools, analysis to help you get through a career path. I'm of the ilk that the more you know, that the more that you experience, the better your choice will be, right? That said, I have met plenty of people that probably do just fine staying in one single function and one silo, if you will. They just develop a deep expertise. And so I don't think there's one size fits all, but generally speaking, people, that's such an individual, and managers have to, the skill of a good manager is to identify and understand those characteristics and either feed them and guide them or let them go, right? And that's tough.
And to be able to do that at scale and with pace, right? Which I think is only going to become two more important variables for corporations continuing forward.
The other interesting piece is a lot of managers, when they find a talent, someone that's a high potential, high performance, right? The classic one box, they love to develop them. They'll give them the leadership training, the coaching, everything like that. And when the person goes to say, hey, thank you for the opportunities, it's time for me to go do something else, the managers go, oh, God, I've spent all this time developing you and, you're perfect or whatever. Either they have them in some sort of succession plan, or you got to let them go, right? Either even outside the company, because in the end, people are going to be who they are. And we know that the average tenure for jobs is 2 to 3 years now. And outside the companies, 4 years is almost eternity for people to stay at companies. I know that may be blasphemy, but that's the reality. So embrace it, right? And that almost goes back to my original point of hire people for what they're great at. And work them, pay them, let them enjoy it. If it's 6 months, great. If it's 2 years, great. Somewhere in the middle, just do it. And don't be afraid, right?
It's easier said than done, but I love the sort of wisdom that lies within and the recognition that parallels with the, like you said, that ever shortened nature of half-life of skills and this rotation. Even though we have, I think it's the first time in history, 6 generations in the workforce en masse across industry, across geo, the idea of the fluidity of that, I think, is only going to sort of ramp massively in terms of the movement of those individuals.
And our systems have to change, right? You can't, the way American healthcare is set up right now, you can't pay temporary, you can't give temporary workers healthcare. There's a whole variety of infrastructure and framework that we've established based on the old IBM, you're going to be here for 30 years model. So somebody has to start thinking about business models that don't, a lot of companies are doing away with PTO, for instance, paid time off, right? You take it when you need it. There are other companies that have this rock solid model of you get 2 years and use it, or all that stuff. I honestly believe, to your point earlier, Todd, people want flexibility. They want to be able to almost dictate the terms. That means, bottom up, top down. We have to look at things differently. And it's heresy to a lot of people. But they probably said the same thing in the Industrial Revolution. Oh, my God. people coming from the farms to take on factories. What are we going to do?
Like, what's the willingness and appetite to accept the nature of the change and the pace that it's coming, which are always challenging pieces for, regardless of what industry you're working in or sort of where you are in your career trajectory.
Exactly.
Perfect. Well, let me do this, Chris. You've been so generous with your time, but we would be remiss if we didn't ask you the last question. When you think about a few of the major influences in your life, maybe inspiring mentors, business coaches, teachers, facilitators, folks, you know, kind of on the Army side, who believed in you and your approach to your career, what sort of comes to mind? Kind of pearls of wisdom, folks that stand out that you want to share as a bit of a close here.
Thanks for asking that question. And old guys like me have a lot of people that have, I'd like to say, you know, contributed to the final sculpture. You know, my parents were certainly influential. You know, my dad owned a family shoe store in upstate New York. He was, you know, from an Italian immigrant family, very progressive in his thinking, right? He just allowed for, he was a disciplinarian. And of course, we had to do a lot of things, but he instilled in me very early on the work ethic, integrity, honesty, you know, treat people well. My dad was a absolute family man and took care of his family. He was a beautiful human being. You know, my mom was a woman in the workforce early on. She just was a powerful force because of her drive, and they were great. Interestingly, my high school wrestling coach, who was also a guy that I painted houses with for many years, he was also a very impactful person because he was a guy that pushed people to their limits, but he was so compassionate, so empathetic. He saw potential. He knew how to draw it out. He was a real big leader. Like he taught us leadership at a young age. One of my military leaders, he was the division surgeon. He was a enlisted guy that in Vietnam went to medical school, put himself through medical school, and then was a colonel. And he was one of my favorite bosses. The guy was just chock full of wisdom, maintained a sense of humor. But more than anything, he taught me a great model of how to work in the world, because he had lived in Japan, he had lived in Germany, he was from Texas, and he just really painted a nice picture for me at a young age. He said something to me that was impactful. He said, "Don't for a minute think that what you do today isn't going to have an impact on you 10, 20 years from now. You touch somebody, you work someplace, you build a relationship," he said, "they'll come back around." And he said that, you know, this is an important piece. And he said, expand your network as far as you possibly can. And then I would say, you know, another person that I'd be remiss, you know, I have an older brother. He's 11 months older. I like to say we're Irish twins. But my older brother has been a guy that has had my back through and through some tough times, a sounding board, someone that I could bounce absolutely insanely wild ideas off of. And I love him for it. We're as close as ever. He actually still lives up in upstate. He's bounced around, but incredibly influential. So, I mean, there's a ton of people. The one thing I will say that I'm grateful for, I knew this right away with Alex. When you meet people that are in your tribe, people that speak the same language, and this may be a little frou-frou for some people, but energetically, you start to understand where there's a connection. And you need to accept that there's a connection that exists, run with it, find it, and support it. And so, you know, the older you get, if you aren't afraid of allowing yourself to make those connections that serve you as well as the other person, you're missing an opportunity. And so every day I feel like there's an opportunity to impact somebody. And I know that's probably a longer answer to the question, but that's really how I feel today.
NovoEd empowers organizations to build deep capabilities rather than mere skills through cohort-based learning that drives true readiness to perform on the job. For more episodes of the Wildly Capable podcast, or for more information on NovoEd, please visit us at novoed.com.